Good afternoon, everyone. Let me know if you can hear me. And I just want to let everybody know that Chief Justice will be a little late today, so we're just going to hang out until he arrives. Thank you.
Is my audio working?
Yes, it is.
Thank you. No, it's not video.
Hi, Kevin.
My PC decided my telephone was my microphone, and so nobody could hear me because I don't. IT claimed it's not possible.
Hi, Almeida.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Excellent. Good to see you. Of
Thank you for holding down the fort.
course.
I unfortunately had to bring my golden retriever to work today, and I had to try and get her settled for a little bit, which is a exercise in futility, actually.
I'll bet.
Have you been keeping track of everybody as they join? So do you have a sense of if we're at a quorum yet or no?
Yes, we do have a quorum.
Oh, perfect. Okay. Let me look around the screen here. Okay. Why don't we go ahead and call the meeting to order then, and you can go ahead and call the roll.
Do. Okay, Chief Justice Herndon,
Present.
Judge Armstrong,
Present.
Judge Birchie, Judge Bishop,
Here.
Judge De La Garza,
Here.
Judge Eyding,
Here.
Evie Grosnick, Judge Harrington, Chris Hicks,
Here.
Chief Judge Higgins.
Present.
Amy Hill.
Here.
Thank you. Judge Hu. Judge Johnson.
Here.
Judge Jones.
Here.
Nancy Lemke.
Here.
Alicia LaRute.
Present.
Garrett Pruitt.
Present.
Judge Riggs. Judge Simons. Judge Soderquist.
I'm here.
Jacob Sommer. Judge Toon,
Here.
Judge Walker, Angelina Wenke,
I'm here.
Steve Wolfson. Okay, and we also have the following guests: Jessica Hickman, Dr. Lanterman, and Caitlin O'Connor. Is there anybody else in attendance that I have not called yet today?
I do have two of my CGI team members with me, Valerie Mead and May Yang.
Thank you very much. And with that, we have a quorum, and it's all yours, Chief.
Perfect. Thank you. Well, welcome everybody. Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate, as always, your time. Let's just hop to agenda item number two quickly so we can get on to the presentations. That's the approval of our meeting minutes from August of this year. Does anybody have any edits or corrections that they wish to make to the meeting minutes? I do not see or hear any objections or suggestions. So, can I get a motion to approve the meeting minutes?
I'll make a motion to approve. It's Judge De La Garza.
Thanks, Melissa. Any second?
I'll
Again,
second.
this is just.
Sorry.
Go ahead. Was that Judge Toon?
Yes.
Thank you. All right, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
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 Anyone opposed? We will note the approval of our August 4th meeting minutes. Okay. Discussion item number three, our presentations. I don't know if any of our three presenters have any time constraints. Does anybody need to go first and get on to something else, or does everybody have plenty of time?
I have plenty of time, but if anyone else needs to go first, I'm happy to let them lead.
Okay, it looks like everybody was kind of shaking their heads no in terms of all being good. So what the way we have it listed on our agenda is CGL first with Ms. O'Connor. So, Ms. O'Connor, why don't you go ahead whenever you're ready? And what we'll do, folks, is we'll go through Ms. O'Connor's presentation, and then we can ask some questions. We'll go through the next presentation, et cetera, and then can kind of follow up with any questions that have come about as the presentations have moved along at the end as well.
Great. Hi, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Caitlin
Afternoon.
O'Connor. I am from CGL Companies. I have been with CGL about a year now. Prior to that, I worked in higher education. And then prior to that, I worked for the state of Rhode Island at the Department of Corrections here for about 10 years. Judge, I'm going to say that my favorite coworker is my golden retriever, who is behind me in my office right now. So.
Well, I'm going to guess, Caitlin, and I apologize for being informal, but at some point you're probably going to see my dog Winnie's head pop up on here because she will jump up on everything at some point in time. So I will
Well, I
apologize
think
in
that,
advance.
hold on, which one? Mine's right there. So,
Ah, yeah. Oh, it's a cream as well. Yeah, mine's a
yeah.
cream
So
too.
you'll probably see his paw sticking up over my head at some point. So I apologize for
Okay.
that. So here we go. So I just want to kind of give you a little bit of information about CGL, what we do, and then talk a little bit about our methodology for our pretrial risk assessments and leave room for any questions that some of the judges might have. So CGL has been a company and been incorporated for, geez, over 5 decades at this point. We are in the forefront of justice planning, operational consulting, and facility design. We also really deliver some comprehensive solutions for public sector clients across the United States and internationally. Within CGL, we have a research division called Research and Forecasting, or we like to call ourselves the RAF. The RAF is really what puts CGL on the forefront of best practices nationally for correction systems throughout the country. We do a lot of population projections. We are subject matter experts in classification systems and pretrial risk assessments. We're able to validate, revalidate instruments. We're able to validate classification systems, et cetera, et cetera. So this kind of work is right in our wheelhouse, and we've been performing this type of work for quite some time. Within the RAF, we have combined over 50 years of experience. We're headed by Wendy Ware, who is formerly the president of JFA, the Institute, out of Denver, Colorado. And she worked alongside Dr. Jim Austin for decades. And I know that Dr. Jim Austin was a found, found, helped found kind of your pretrial assessment system and has revalidated it in the past. So Wendy was Dr. Austin's right-hand woman for many years. So she has an intimate knowledge of Nevada and some of the ins and outs of your system over there. So basically, when we start a pretrial risk assessment, the first thing we do is talk to our jurisdictions about data availability. What kind of data do you have? How is it extractable? If it's not extractable, how do we do some workarounds? So that's kind of the first task that we tackle when we do a project like this. We really get with the people who we need to as it relates to how your data is stored and extracted, and we come up with a game plan for how to get that data over to CGL in a secure manner. And within 1 month, we talk about data availability, your systems, and then we come up with a data collection strategy. So, some jurisdictions are able to extract data right from their system and send it to us, while other jurisdictions may need a little bit of help doing that. So we have some expertise in data extraction, but we also understand that some jurisdictions need manual entry of data, that they keep things like pretrial risk assessments in manual, physical forms. So we have the ability to get those forms and then manually turn it into a database for you all. So that brings us to kind of our third task that we typically do in such a situation is we do data entry and preparation. So we clean your data, we make sure that it looks all right and that it is consistent with what your jurisdiction typically sees. And so that takes us about 1 to 2 months. At that point, we're into about month 3 or 4 within this whole validation strategy. Something that we do is inter-rater reliability testing. So inter-rater reliability testing means that we want to ensure that your staff are scoring things the same manner. So typically what we do is we take a random sample of a certain amount of cases and we have a secondary staff member score them to ensure that there's consistency in scoring across your staff and how they're using your tool. And that's, a very important piece of this because we need to ensure that, the staff are doing things in the same way so that our results are useful and we know that they are, that this is going to be evidence-based. After that, we do our statistical validation. So really what we're looking for are failure to appears, rearrest rates, outcomes like that. So that's what we're looking to. If your pretrial risk assessment, you should be predicting whether or not people are going to have high failure to appear rates, rearrest rates, et cetera. So we look at Every scoring item in your risk assessment, we compare that to those rates of failure to appear, rearrest, and then we test for the weight. So are the scoring mechanisms being weighted correctly? Is one question, should be it weighted more than another? And we do all of that through all of this information that we're able to receive. Once that statistical validation is done, that brings us into about month 5, and we typically look at the preliminary findings. So we get together with your judges, with your pretrial staff, and we say, hey, these are our initial findings. Do these make sense? Is this, how anecdotally you see things? And we'll go through kind of some of our recommendations from that meeting. We draft a report. That report is shared. We kind of go back and forth to make sure that it's hitting all the right marks. And then we provide a final report by month 6. So that final report will be an updated tool, updated scoring guidelines, an updated manual, and recommendations for future validation increments. So, should this be revalidated for every 5 years, which is typically what we find standard, every 3 years for something that, may have a few more issues that we see. And so that brings us to about a 6-month timeline for getting this validation done. So the kind of the things that we look at, like I said, are data feasibility, what kind of data do you have, how is it stored? We look at, the methodology. We take data from 2022 on to ensure that people have enough time to fail to appear or to be rearrested, so that we have like some nice brand new data that we're looking at. We can compare the different NPR versions that I know might be floating around to ensure that the scoring is correct for each of the versions. We sometimes will identify new risk factors that we believe should be included into your risk assessments if that's what we're seeing in the data. So there is an example of, there might be a risk factor that you're not thinking of that might be beneficial for you. And so that's kind of in a nutshell how we do this. I will say that CGL does tens of these a year. We have done, I think, over the past year, about 4 pretrial risk assessment validations in Maryland alone. We have a really strong background in validations and revalidations. So we pretty much have it down to a science with how these operate and how they work, and the results and the drafting of the reports and the recommendations on how to move forward. So we can expect to be able to finish this quite easily within 6 months. And then on top of that, we do have the ability to come on site and train your staff if that's something that you would want us to do. So oftentimes a lot of jurisdictions will have us come out to train their staff to look at new recommendations and how those should be implemented, and to ensure that everyone's scoring them and understands any new scoring recommendations that we put forth in our final report. So like I said, in a nutshell, that's kind of how we handle a validation like this. We're well versed in it, and we do it quite often. So I'm going to pause there for any questions anyone may have.
Anybody have any questions at this point for Ms. O'Connor?
I have a question.
Sure.
I was looking for the button to raise my hand to be asked properly. Sorry. My name's
No
Angela.
worries.
I'm the pretrial services manager for Washoe County. If for this statistical or for this reval, what is the sample size that you would be looking for from each jurisdiction?
Right. So it depends on the size of the jurisdiction. We would have to look at your population, how many you do every year. But typically we want a sample size that's about 50% of the number of pretrial risk assessments we do every year.
From each jurisdiction?
Right. Yes.
Do you have an opinion on how many jurisdictions should be involved in this study, and what type of jurisdiction should be involved to appropriately norm the tool for Nevada?
Right. So my understanding is that our initial scope of work we provided was to do this throughout all jurisdictions, and then we were asked to look at only 3 jurisdictions for this, which would be the Washoe, Clark County, and Ely Justice Center. So those were the 3 that we provided a scope of work for. I mean, Typically, we would want to have as many counties as possible involved to make sure that it could be valid for the, your entire system. From my understanding, those are the three largest areas. So we could make the argument that because those are the largest areas, that it could be reflective of the entire population.
Judge De La Garza.
I have a little bit of a question about the data. Of course, in Clark County, you would get justice court data in terms of preparation of the NPRs, but how do you go about getting the data for rearrests? Because here, somebody might not be, just because they're rearrested, they might not come back through Las Vegas Justice Court. So how does that work? How do you get the data from, let's say, our Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department? How does that work?
Right. So typically, how we do it in most jurisdictions is that we create data tracking forms. So for the random samples that we provide, that the jurisdiction provides us, they also get a data tracking form that they would tell us for that individual how many rearrests they had, how many failure to appears they have, because us as CGL as a private company, we don't have access to data like that. So it is a little bit more work for pretrial services or whoever would be tasked with providing those sheets back to us. But otherwise, we don't have access to that information. So that would be a collaborative effort. And like I said, typically we create the data tracking sheet for each individual. And that's where I think what Angelina was talking about, 50% is what we would hope to do for a random sample, but we also have to weigh that with the feasibility for people's workloads and the bandwidth that they have to assist with some of that data collection, on the front end.
Judge
To
Bishop.
follow up on that, I don't think that's going to work because if I have somebody of one of my people here who's OR'd and they go to Eureka County and commit a crime and get rearrested, nobody in my office would ever know. And even worse in Vegas, if they are released in Vegas and they cross the river into Arizona and murder somebody, we're not going to know about that necessarily.
Yeah, so in other jurisdictions, what they do, it's not county level, it's statewide. So a lot of states have statewide systems that you can look an individual up that will tell you, were they arrested, were they rearrested, they have a failure to appear, not only on a state level, but sometimes even beyond just that state level. So I'm not quite sure how it works in Nevada, but that's typically how we do it in any other jurisdiction throughout the country.
During the original validation of the tool, my team reran in CJIS for criminal rearrest. So is the form that you would be providing just say something like, was there a rearrest? And then we would
Correct.
have to go gather that information likely from CJIS. We don't have a Nevada state
Right. Yeah. So CJIS
CGI.
is another way that we could do that. Absolutely, that you would gather that information. It would be very easy, check yes, no, depending on what the jurisdiction wants to see. Sometimes they'll even add additional information from what kind of rearrest was it? Was it a violent rearrest versus a nonviolent? So that, unfortunately for you, Angelina, a lot of that work may come to your team, but we've always had a really great working relationship, with those frontline workers who have to work with us to get some of that information extracted.
Just by way of context, for the last 3 years, the average amount of NPRAs that my team has done alone for Washoe County is between 8,000 and 9,000. So 8,500 NPRAs for Washoe County, and I expect that those have increased this year.
So
So,
for I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but Angelina, for a county about your size, we'd probably be looking for about 500 then.
okay. Angelina, this is Judge De La Garza. Did you say 8,000 to 9,000 each year or for the total 3 years?
No, each year. So in 2021, we did
almost 9,000 2022, 8,000 2023, 8,600 2024, 8,622. So we do between 8 and 9,000 a year, and that involves different jurisdictions such as Sparks Justice Court. We've began doing a couple of years ago now doing NPRAs for less serious misdemeanors, where in municipal courts we don't do it. If somebody gets arrested for petty larceny, we won't do an NPRA, whereas we have increased those.
Amy,
Yeah, I
what
just.
type of numbers are we looking at? Because if we're looking at 50%, and you said, Caitlin, from 2022, so you're looking at doing this for 22, 23, 24?
No. So typically what we do is we have a cohort of individuals within 1 year. So something like 2022 or 2023, because then we want to give them enough time to either succeed or fail. So it'd be a cohort of individuals who had an NPR within typically 1 year, and then we give them that, 1 to 3 years to then either fail or succeed to follow them through. So it wouldn't be from each year. It's a cohort of people, and then we follow up with them to look at what their FTA and rearrest rates were. And then for a cut, like I said, for a county this size, we need to balance the fact that this is going to be a lot of legwork for pretrial services with what is statistically significant. So, for a county that's doing about 8 to 9,000 of those a year, if those aren't easily extracted through your data system, and then we would have to manually input the data for every pretrial risk assessment, we knock those numbers down a little bit because we need to balance feasibility, staff bandwidth on your end as well.
Now, I know we're revalidating the whole NPRA, but is there any way to give any kind of feedback back to individual courts or individual judges? Like, we've done the review, and Judge Higgins, you have a 0% FTA, so that means you're holding too many people. And Judge Johnson, you have 100% FTA, so maybe you ought to keep some people in jail in Esmeralda County. I mean, is there any kind of like
Amy,
a
stop
per
it.
court or per judge feedback? Because we're operating in a vacuum here. I have no
Yeah.
idea how I'm doing.
Right. So there certainly could be, and I think that goes with how you are keeping your pretrial risk assessments. Are you identifying where they come from? What court are they coming from? And if so, when we do a random sample, that random sample should look like your bigger population in general, because that's the idea of a random sample. So as long as we're able to identify what courts they're coming from, we can cut the data down even further to understand the differences, whether it's judges, courts, counties, etc.
So maybe just one quick follow-up, Chief.
Yeah,
So
absolutely.
how do we tell the difference between if the NPRA is working or the judges are working? So maybe the NPR is great, but people aren't using it right. Or maybe the NPRA's got a big hole in it and the judges are working around that. How do we tell the difference between those?
So for a lot of the stats that we do, we can control for certain factors. So the more data we have, the more controls we can put in place to identify kind of the nuances between how this is working, what the outcomes are, et cetera. And especially when we're, cutting it down to the county level. So I think that would kind of look at our methodology, and then look at some of those controlling factors that we can identify as we're doing the data analysis.
Caitlin, can I jump in here again? It's Della Garza from Clark County. So for us, for Las Vegas Justice Court, oh, I guess we do North Las Vegas and Henderson also. Here in Clark County, we did 23,383 NPRs just from January to August of this year. So what kind of sample number do you think that we would be looking at so that I can kind of get an idea of what kind of workload I'm going to be putting on my pretrial services division if in fact they're the ones that are going to have to be filling out the forms?
Right. So Judge De La Garza, I would ask first, How are your NPR stored? Are they stored electronically where we can extract them, or are they in paper form? So I think that makes a big difference with how many we would seek to look at. But for a jurisdiction that's that large, I would say between 500 and 1,000 individuals, in the NPRs. So I would say around that percentage, what is what we would like to see.
I kind of have three questions. When you said the sample number was 15 or 50, 1-5 or 5-0?
So again, it depends on the jurisdiction side. For a smaller jurisdiction, we like to have 50%. For a larger jurisdiction, like we're dealing with in Nevada, it's not feasible to have that many when the data isn't stored in an electronic manner, and when we have to have staff do the CGIS, backgrounds to fill out these data forms. So typically, again, if we're in a small jurisdiction in Maryland that's doing 1,000 of these a year, we would look for 500 of them, about 50%. But we have to understand that different jurisdictions operate in different ways and work within the boundaries and the feasibility that is available in that jurisdiction.
Do you have any idea? I mean, how many does Ely do on a yearly basis?
The whole district had 712 criminal cases, according to the annual report of 2023.
Okay.
So, I mean, we'd have to pull in the 6th, the 7th, the 10th, and the 11th to get close to 15% of what Vegas does.
Okay.
But that was going to be my next question.
Okay.
Right, so it's not 50% of what Vegas does. It's for your particular jurisdiction. So if you're only doing 300 to 400 MPAs a year, we would only need a sample of about 200 to 300 in your case.
We did 279 criminal cases in 2023 per the book.
Right, and then what we do is we ask you for a snapshot of your population, and then we look at our random sample and we compare the two to make sure they're comparable. So to make sure that on a daily basis, this is what your population looks like, and this is what our random sample looks like. We want to make sure that they have about the same proportion of males and females. We look at typically race just to make sure that the sample is representative of the population in general.
Because I'm super interested in that data and I'd really like to know, but is that going to be valuable to anybody else with such a small sample size?
I mean, it absolutely could because even though your sample size is smaller, your jurisdiction is different than
Okay.
Las Vegas in the bigger jurisdiction. So understanding how the NPR is working for your population, in my opinion, is just as important as knowing how it's working for Las Vegas.
And final question, do we really need to look at 2 to 3 years after the NPRA if this is just a pretrial?
So no, I mean, with a pretrial, we usually look 1 year out.
Okay. That would shorten up a lot of the work we'd have to do too.
Right.
How many criminal cases did you say you had, Steve?
According to the book, 279, and I would guess about 200 of those got an NPRA.
Okay. 200. Yet another reason I often contemplate moving to Ely when I get out of this job.
Yeah.
It's very
Or
nice.
Esmeralda. Or
We only
Esmeralda.
did
I'll come there.
25 last year. Wow.
25
Crazy. Yeah, two five
criminal
people.
cases?
Yeah.
Two five. Two
Correct.
five.
Yes,
It only says
25.
three in here, Danielle.
That does not surprise me.
Judge
That's a
Johnson,
less
I'll
distant
take
place.
all 25 of yours.
There you go.
Okay, I'll give
So
them to you. Easy.
let me just ask Steve and Ely, since you're part of this, do you all have it digitized so that they can extract it, or is it all on paper?
It's all on paper.
Okay.
And we'll have to go to the district court to get them because most of it went over there.
And Angelina or Amy, what about in Washoe and Clark? Are they digitized for extraction?
Ours are uploaded into Odyssey, so they should be able to be extracted.
Okay. Angelina? Yeah?
Yes, we have multiple digitized formats.
Okay. All right. So I don't think that probably Ms. O'Connor should be too much of a problem since those are
Right.
all available for digital. And then Ely is obviously, you said earlier, the largest jurisdictions, but Washoe and Clark are our two largest jurisdictions. Ely is kind of representative of one of the less populous or rural jurisdictions. So we wanted to have that balance in there.
Absolutely.
Okay. Were there any other questions right now? I do not see any other questions right now. Did you have anything else that you wanted to add right now, Mr. O'Connor, or you want to wait?
No, but it was nice meeting everyone, and thank you for your time.
You are the second person from Stonehill College that I have now met in my lifetime. So.
Oh, yeah? It's a great college.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and move on to the CJI scope of work from Ms. Hickman.
Yes, thank you. And I'm going to actually let my deputy director, Valerie Mead, kick us off while I try to share my screen.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for your time today. We're excited to be here and talking with you. Like Jess said, my name is Valerie Mead. I'm deputy director at CJI. Here with me today is Jessica Hickman, who's a manager over our pre-adjudication, pre-trial work. And then also Dr. May Yang, who is a senior data and policy specialist with CJI and can speak to methodology, answer questions about our proposed approach, those sort of things. So I'm going to start just with a really quick overview of CJI, who we are, what we do, and then pass you over to Jess, who will go through the work that we're proposing here, and also some specific reasons why we feel like we're uniquely qualified to do this work for you all in Nevada. And then we will wrap up by talking about methodology and then answering any questions that you all might have. So just real quickly, Crime and Justice Institute, CJI, is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that has been working with state and local governments across the country for over two decades. We have done some work in Nevada, which we will talk about here briefly. We are currently doing some work in Nevada, and we have previously done some work in Nevada. And some of you who are on this call have been part of that. I saw DA Hicks on here, so good to see you again. CJI really sees our value add to the field as helping reduce the gap between research and practice by providing data-driven technical assistance and training opportunities. We have portfolios that work within all of the different decision points throughout the justice system, both adult and youth justice. All the way from pre-adjudication, pre-trial, through conviction, community supervision, institutional corrections, reentry, and then again, the full youth justice profile that follows all of the decision points along that route as well. I will pass you over to Jess now, who can give an overview of the work that we're proposing and then also what makes us uniquely qualified.
We did put together a few slides, but it looks like screen sharing is locked. Is it okay for me to screen share?
Sorry, I couldn't find my mute button. Let me sort that out. Sorry, I didn't clue into that earlier.
No worries if not. We just like a good visual.
I can find you on my list here. I should be able to give you sharing rights, and then you'll be able to sign or to share. There you are. Okay. All right. You're now co-host. Go ahead and try to share.
All right. That worked. Are you all seeing that?
Yes,
on your screens? Perfect. Okay, so we can skip this first slide. Val already covered that. We just have a A couple of slides for you just to give you a sense of what we are proposing to do. This just reflects the scope of work that we previously shared. And this scope of work covers the three jurisdictions that were included in the development of the tool and the revalidation. So we'll speak a little bit to that and how we're going to differentiate the analyses. But typically when we approach a validation, we are really trying to answer three main research questions. First, is the tool working as a whole, as it was designed? Is it predictive of pretrial outcomes for the jurisdictions that we are looking at? And the two main outcomes that we tend to look for are failures to appear and new criminal activity, depending on how the jurisdictions define new criminal activity. It could be arrest, it could be a charge. We go by what's typical. We also look at whether the in this case, MPRA risk levels are accurately kind of sorting out failure outcomes. So for example, do the people who are scored out as low risk, do they actually have a lower pretrial failure rate than people who are scored out as medium or high risk? And then finally, we look to see whether the MPRA is consistent and accurate across subgroups, males, females, different races, ethnicity. Again, also depending on what's available in the data, but we typically look at race and gender. The reason we ask these questions is we have a couple of goals that we're looking to deliver for you, which is the MPRA working as it was designed to work? Is it predictive of pretrial failure outcomes for your jurisdictions? We really want to, in this case, because you're looking at three jurisdictions that are so vastly different, we want to look at a combined data set using all three jurisdictions as a whole. And although this won't give us a perfect picture of how it's working for Nevada as a state, because every jurisdiction is so different, it will get us a better idea, a closer idea to how it's working statewide. And then we also want to look at each individual location's data because pretrial practices are different. We saw that, you know, population sizes are different, how you score out the tool is different. And we want to be able to tell you if there are differences in predictive validity based on local jurisdiction and local populations and policies. And of course, looking at the different subgroups as well. And we do all of that to help you really better understand how the tool's working for you and to give you some meaningful and actionable recommendations on if it's working great, awesome, keep doing what you're doing. Or if there are some areas for potential improvement, we would like to identify those and give you some next steps on how you can potentially implement that moving forward. And for a validation like this one, where we would like to look at three jurisdictions as a whole and also separately, we plan for about a 9-month project to be able to do that. And these are just a few steps that we typically take, which is first looking at data transfer, and then based on the data that are available, finalizing our analysis plan. And that is a collaborative process, lots of communication back and forth between our team and your teams. Then looking at the available data, we compile our data sets. So doing some merging and cleaning to look at that, you know, combined three jurisdiction project validation, as well as having the separate data sets for each location. And then I have in here outcome measures, because sometimes we find that the outcome measures are not available in the data as is, and we are able to kind of put them together so that you can look at those key outcomes, such as failure to appear and new criminal activity that we look at for a validation. We do include staff scoring fidelity exercises. That is a huge component to any validation. As Caitlin talked about, you want to know if the tool's not working because it's the risk factors going into it, or are staff not consistently scoring it out how they should be. And so this fidelity exercises will give us some insight into that. And then obviously we'll get you some coaching and provide you recommendations on how maybe if it is staff scoring and not the tool itself, how you can boost that predictability. Then after we have all of that set, we'll run analyses on the merged data set and for each local jurisdiction. We tend to like to review initial results just to do a gut check to make sure that what we're finding lines up with what you know is happening on the ground, because you are all experts in your jurisdictions. And so we want to kind of do that initial review and then go back and rerun analyses or explore a little bit deeper if there are some discrepancies there. And I'm actually going to take a quick break. May, I'm going to call on you. May is our validation expert to talk just a little bit about what our analyses typically look like.
Thanks, Jess. I'm trying to find my unmute button as well. So I can talk a little bit about our data extraction process, cleaning process, and also what analysis will go into the validation. So we, CDI has experiences with data extraction in different ways. We have been given direct access to the case management system in different jurisdictions before, and then we're actually the ones to perform the queries in those systems and pull the data directly. We have worked with text files, CSV files. PDF scripting is also possible. It sounds like there are paper records, and we can work with that too, with a smaller sample size. So data extraction typically will include pulling data from different agencies of the jurisdiction, depending on how the case management structure, the data management system looks like, and what data is available to which agency. So there will be data manipulations and data merging efforts needed in order to create a compiled file of all the data from different agencies for the validation to happen before any further data cleaning is possible. In terms of data cleaning, we usually would make sure that we're only including people who are released on pretrial at some point. So perhaps there is a risk assessment performed that that person is detained and not at liberty of failing to appear for court or getting a new arrest during the pretrial phase. So again, we will make sure we're only including people who are released at least at some point during pretrial. We sometimes would see that the case timelines don't make sense. Sometimes we see that a case is filed before arrest happens. So we want to filter out the cases that where the case timelines all line up. We are going to make sure the risk factor add up to the score. And like Jess mentioned, we oftentimes will need to create outcome variables, especially for re-arrest. Just circling back to the question that was asked before. So usually the jurisdictions don't have a readily available indicator as to whether this person has been rearrested during the pretrial phase. I remember in my experience, there is only one jurisdiction that was able to provide us with that data directly. So we typically would pull arrest data from available agencies, from the agencies that can provide us with the data, and connect the arrest data back to the person's case, and just looking at whether there are any arrests that fall within the pretrial period to create that rearrest variable. And in terms of I don't remember, is that was quite, Judge Melissa, is that your question about whether that is going to be able to capture the cases that don't go through your court? That is actually a very common limitation when it comes to validation, that the jurisdictions don't really have access to data other than the data of their own local court. So depending on, how the validation will eventually pan out, if we would have access to other jurisdictions, although they're not part of the validation, but if we would have arrest data and there is a reliable way to connect the arrest data, I think that is the way that we can capture the new arrest if the case doesn't go through your jurisdiction. But that is actually a very common limitation, that the new arrest is only within the jurisdiction that is being captured. And again, like Jess mentioned, every jurisdiction's data management availability could be different. So we're providing a consolidated sample analysis and also separate analysis for each site. And sorry.
Can I ask, May, on that particular question,
yes,
are we then responsible for providing you with that data on the rearrest, or is that something that you will, as part of your research, go out and obtain from other agencies, let's say Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department or NCIC or SCOPE, those type of things? Are you responsible for that, or is my staff responsible for obtaining that data?
Just please jump in here. I think that we eventually, depending on the nature of the data sharing agreement, we may need your assistance in connecting us with the right people, but we can be the one reaching out to them, obtaining data from them, confirming the availability of the data and making sure it actually works. So the answer is we will need your assistance in making sure that we're reaching out to the right people who can potentially provide us with the data, but we can be the one compiling the data and creating that outcome measure. Just.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We just would need to know who to reach out to be able to make sure we're getting access to the right data sets. And then that may or may not require a separate data sharing agreement, depending if it's a whole new jurisdiction or a different agency. But we tend to have those conversations up front. If we were to get this project, we go through a few things, including our data request and our typical sharing agreement, to make sure that our bases are covered when we need to go out and do a little bit of extra digging for that data. Other questions for May?
I'll ask my question that everybody laughs at, but we're going to get a 30,000 foot report here on whether the NPRA is working. But what kind of feedback do we get on a per court or per judge basis? You know, every 10 years we revalidate. I don't know if I'm doing a good job or not. I hope I am. But if I have a 0% FTA, well, I'm not letting enough people out. If I have 100% recidivism, well, I'm letting too many people out. But is there a way for you to report that data back to us on a per judge or per court basis?
May, do you want to start and then I can back you up?
Yeah, absolutely. So we will provide recommendations in different areas. We would talk about, we'll provide recommendations about data tracking, data management, the validity of the data itself, you know, how we can track data just more consistently with greater fidelity. And we look into not just risk level and risk score, but with each individual risk factor. Does it perform well? Are there any risk factors that are performing better than others, worse than others? And equally importantly, we look into whether these risk factor, risk level, risk score are performing consistently across different demographic groups. So we're going to provide recommendations as to whether any adjustments are needed to these risk factors, and if so, what those adjustments would look like. And we also typically would provide recommendations as to how we can expand or just making the data tracking a little more consistent and how different agencies and jurisdictions can collaborate. So that also to address Judge Melissa's questions about what if the data aren't really captured by my own jurisdiction, if there's a better way to just make data tracking more consistent across different jurisdictions and how we can expand that, how we can make the data tracking more consistent, more standardized. So we'll talk about that too. Jess, did I miss anything?
Yeah, I'm going to jump.
Putting my judge hat on, I guess the answer is no.
It depends, right? It depends because we haven't seen your data. And often we find we want to look at that by judge, but that information is just not available to us. In an ideal world,
I have no idea what my FTA rate is. I couldn't tell you.
So yeah, in an ideal world, we would be able to break it down by court, by judge, if that exists. And also, one thing we like to look at, often can't, but ideally would look at, is the concurrence rate or agreement rate between what a judge decides to do at pretrial release and what the assessment had recommended, right? Because you were asking, I think, that question earlier, like, how do I know if it's me that's making really great decisions, that's making this outcome awesome, or if it's the tool that's working? Like, how do I know the difference between that? Because obviously a judge is looking at many different pieces of information as well as the assessment. It's just one tool in the toolbox. It does not decide what happens to someone at that initial decision point. And so a concurrence rate is looking at what the assessment recommends based on the predetermined risk factors, and then what the judge ends up doing, and if there were overrides involved. So we could look at overrides at the pretrial staff level. We could look at overrides at the judge level to see kind of how that plays out and how that might impact predictability. That said, it depends a lot on what's available in your data. And there are often some limitations around what gets tracked, because that is one thing that might not be captured.
So I, with my judge hat, I heard a maybe.
A maybe. It's a strong maybe.
All right.
With respect to what data you're looking for, this question is going to help narrow down the availability of a answer for Judge Higgins. So what are you looking for data collection for are we talking about the initial bail only? We have many times in our population, no doubt in all of the, you know, state of Nevada, where somebody will have an initial bail set and then another judge will take another look at it and OR the defendant. A bail is set at $500, and then another judge looks at it 2 days later and ORs the defendant. And then 6 weeks later, the defendant is revoked for a technical violation. And then the defendant has to post a $1,000 bail. Are you looking at a history for that defendant for the entire case? How many times they were given bail and getting out? Or are we just talking about that original bail?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. We do look at the life of the case. As long as someone was released at any point within their case duration, we will include that if they had a risk assessment completed. So, for example, in that case that you were just talking about, they would be included, right? Because at some point they were released pretrial. But if someone was detained the entire pretrial period, we don't include those cases because they didn't have an opportunity to bail. Pre-trial. Sure. They didn't have an opportunity to miss court or get a new arrest or charge, which is the outcomes that we're looking for.
Exactly. So when I am going to collect this data to give to you, I close down the case. If a defendant is rearrested, I will close down that case, but that case is not disposed yet. Then that case reopens when they post bail again, and then they have another bite at the apple. So when our collective teams in Nevada are looking to pull data for this, we will have to tell the story of that defendant with that case, correct?
So let me just ask you this. Is there, when you close and open cases, are there numbers that are associated with a person, or do you have new numbers that are only associated with individual cases that you open and close?
There's different systems. All of our, you know, I know Vegas has different systems for both assessment and supervision side too. Forgive me if I'm speaking out of school. We have different systems depending on which side we're talking about for different courts. Another problem with Judge Higgins' request is that there's so many people that touch that case and set bail. There's judge, he can set bail in the morning bail reviews, and then by the afternoon, the person goes to court, or the next morning they go to court, and his colleague will set a completely different bail. So it's, and then they'll wave up to the district court level. And I know our judges want to know what the district court, or at least some of them do on the district court bench, like, what is my FTA rate? But how many people have touched that case is going to be very difficult unless we're narrowing it down to what is the initial bail? How did they do on the initial bite at the apple? So I just want to be sure when I am
conceptualizing how much data I'm going to be collecting. It'll be collecting data for the life of that case with that one defendant.
I have a question, actually. So, Angelina, could you tell me when a new bail is set, will there be another risk assessment validation performed? Or is the risk assessment not a risk assessment validation? Will there be another risk assessment performed, or there will only be one risk assessment for the life of the case?
That's a great question. I don't know how Vegas does it, but in Washoe County, if somebody absconds and a warrant is put out, then we will do a new risk assessment upon rearrest. But if there's a technical violation and somebody has was a it was a technical violation and they are remanded for something, then there won't be a new NPRA. Is that consistent with Vegas, guys?
Yes. Yeah.
So I asked this question because that does complicate things a little bit because we need to differentiate, which risk assessment is to which part of the pretrial period, essentially. But that will be on me, not on you. You can just give the data to me, and I can just looking at, the dates and then match the risk assessment to the correct part of the pretrial period.
Angelina, do you guys not have Odyssey or CourtView, or you're really using an entirely different system?
We have three. Well, if you talk about Odyssey, like the court system, like our pretrial system is different than our court system. So our NPRAs are going into Odyssey, like they're going into not Odyssey for the lower courts, for the justice court levels, and then our NPRAs are going into Context for the district court level. So, or they're going a lot of different places. One system at the jail does all the NPRAs. But then all the courts are going to have different systems. So yes, they're different systems, but one jail team is doing all the NPRAs with that data. But then after it waves to the district court, it's a different level. It's going somewhere else.
But your NPRA goes into Odyssey, and then you see it's uploaded as an exhibit, let's say, and then your judge is making its determinations based on an NPR. So you can see the life. If you look at the register of actions, you can see NPR, arrest, NPRA, bail decision. The proceeding, the trial, the preliminary hearing. So they would just basically need the Odyssey case, the criminal case, to look at your NPRA and then see what the judge based their decision on, right?
Yes.
Okay.
When you say the NPRA goes into Odyssey or whatever system it is, what do you mean by that? Are they physically putting in question one, 2 points, question two, 3 points, or are you just scanning and uploading the paper?
Scanning and uploading the paper.
So that's going to be harder for these validators to pull that data because they're going to have to look at a scanned copy and essentially type it in themselves. It's not going to be something you can just pull, is it?
Yeah, they could they the if they needed to pull the NPRA itself, they could just print it
But then
or
they're going to have to enter all of that data they just printed into their magic system. There's
there
not
would
going to
be
be like
ways
click a
to
button that's going to
script
pull it.
a I think there'll be ways to script the PDFs.
Okay.
That will not be manual.
Because I put in I put them in CourtView, but I just put in the total number. That's not going to help you at all.
Your NPRA isn't scanned into the case itself.
We're
It's
all
scanned into
paper.
Odyssey.
We're all paper.
Oh, yeah. Then I.
Yeah.
Well, luckily, that's a much smaller number. I
Yeah.
mean, so
Yeah,
at
that's
least when you're
200.
looking at the bigger jurisdiction and the bigger number of cases, at least that is automated.
Well, we
So then.
control those and scan them real easy.
Yeah, I was about to say, Steve, why aren't they scanned? Just there wasn't any necessity, or?
Everything we do is on paper, so there's nowhere to, we don't have anywhere we'd put it.
Okay.
So, I mean, we could scan them, but it would just sit on a file somewhere. We'd never access it. So.
Well, you'd access it if you were using your computer rather than grabbing the paper. But point being, you have the ability to scan them. It's just not a procedure that you all have utilized.
Right.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. Just because we don't have a system to put them in.
Got it. Got it. Okay.
CourtView 3, though.
CourtView 3, we're waiting. All right. Did anybody else have any questions for Dr. Yang, Ms. Mead, or Ms. Hickman?
I just thought of one other thing. Is it really necessary to go look at subsequent MPRAs that are done on somebody? If they score a medium or a high and then they screw up, we know they screwed up. Is there much data value in finding out they screwed up twice? We know they're a screw up.
Yeah, but you're setting another bail. So are you following the second NPR?
I don't do a second one. You screw up, that's the end of it.
You're
Yeah, so
entitled
sorry.
to bail.
I mean, I said a bail, but you're not getting it out.
Yeah, so like Jess mentioned, we're only looking at pretrial periods when there is at least one bit of time when people are not detained. So if a person got arrested or failed to appear and they're not being released again, that will be like automatically excluded from the study.
That's weird.
Unless there is another MPRA and the person's released again, then that triggers another observation for the study.
But that could really screw up our data because then Joe Smith could have four screw ups, which then skews Jane Doe's ones. One person could create multiple screw ups and offset decent people who are being okay.
So
There's a lot more moving parts to this than I ever thought about.
there are, and it can be different because I'm already hearing so many different policies that are in place that are just vary between each jurisdiction, even here. We
Welcome
are
to Nevada.
hoping in an ideal world, right, that risk assessment would capture someone's greater likelihood of failure. Right? So that it's telling the difference between that person who's following the rules and the person who is messing up a couple of times. Like that new MPRA should capture that enhanced risk, that elevated risk. And so that's what we're trying to test here, to make sure that it's actually predicting what failure might happen, or that the risk of failure for individuals. And there are other methodology that we can use. If that is the case, a person can be released and then have another MPRA. And another, Eli, what I'm hearing here, and correct me if I'm wrong, is your worry is people who are screwing up multiple times being overrepresented in the data and sort of like bias the results. There are statistical methods. I won't go into the details, but there are statistical methodology to correct for that kind of like within person bias. If that is the case, and after we get the data and we determine that is a needed
Awesome.
approach. But yeah, there are statistical corrections that we can do to mitigate the issue at least. But just for the yeah, for the meeting, we only have 2 hours today, so I won't go into details of that math stuff.
This is fascinating.
All right, and Ms. Hickman, I apologize. I forgot. Did we just take a pause in the presentation of slides while we started answering questions, or did you all have more to talk about?
We had a couple more just to give you a sense of our experience with validations. We just
Okay.
wanted to share a couple of examples of very recent work that we've done. And essentially, this is just showing you that we have done work in a lot of different types of jurisdictions. We've done work in rural Tennessee, where they do have paper files that we had to scan in and read PDFs. We know how to merge in complicated and different data sets from agencies that use different systems. May is a genius at that. And so some of the questions coming up, like, what is the level of effort that I'm going to have my staff do to make this possible? And Our answer is very limited. We can do the work on our end. We've done it before, statewide, different counties. May has seen so many different types of data sets. I don't know that you could throw anything at her that she hasn't already worked with. So just to give you a little ease of mind there. And then, yeah, we actually recently kicked off a kind of, I guess, a precursor validation in Clark County, Las Vegas Justice Court. So we are hoping to get a head start with that data to be able to give you some early indicators of predictive validity. And then lastly, we're a little bit familiar with Nevada's data just because of other work that we have done in the state over the last few years with the Justice Reinvestment Initiative. We have been doing some ongoing sustainability work, looking at different types of data from Nevada, as well as some behavioral health initiatives. So not only are we familiar with messy and sometimes incomplete data sets from various sizes of jurisdictions using various types of data collection systems, but we are familiar with Nevada's data as well. That is all we kind of wanted to leave you with, but we very much appreciate you inviting us to be here. And if you have any other questions, happy to answer them.
Anybody else have any questions at this time? I do not see any. Okay, Ms. Hickman, Ms. Mead, Dr. Yang, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And we will go ahead and move over to our last presentation from Dr. Lanterman.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Jen Lanterman for the record. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss the revalidation of the MPRA with you today. Today, I'm coming to you in my capacity as a professor of criminal justice and the director of the Grant Sawyer Center for Justice Studies at the University of Nevada, Reno. Grant Sawyer Center is a research unit at UNR that focuses on justice-related research broadly defined. We have extensive experience working with legal system agencies throughout Nevada. So we're working with law enforcement, working with the courts, Department of Corrections, probation and parole. We're working with county jails, both in our urban, rural and frontier jurisdictions throughout the state. And specifically, sort of in the same universe as this project, we aided in the implementation and validation of the Ohio or Nevada risk assessment system, which throughout the state is referred to either as the ORAS or the NRAS, depending on when you did your training. So we have both experience with risk assessment validation, as well as knowledge of the legal system context in Nevada. For this particular project, the research team would include a doctoral level research associate. He is much like May, a statistics whiz. Any statistics question you can throw at him, he can answer. A doctoral level graduate research assistant who does a lot of the heavy lifting with respect to data collection and entry. So that does alleviate some degree of the work on the respective agencies and myself. With respect to the initial scope of work, we proposed a scope of work for all of the counties throughout the state, and we can revisit that when we talk about prospective sample sizes. In terms of the research questions and the methods, these are very similar to what's proposed by CJL and CJI. These are fairly standard in terms of instrument revalidation. When it comes to outcomes, specifically failures to appear and rearrest during the pretrial period, that tends to be where some of the sticking point is in terms of sources of data. Our failures to appear data will come from the respective courts. There has been some discussion about the rearrest data. One place I would look, ultimately, however, the committee chooses to proceed with this project, might be having a conversation with the Nevada Criminal History Repository to determine whether or not you might be able to access statewide rearrest data through that repository. And that alleviates a lot of the data collection challenges if we can get those data from that repository. And so if those data are available there, then whomever is ultimately selected to do the revalidation study can work with the repository to determine whether or not there could just be a direct data sharing agreement, and the repository will share the information directly with the group doing the revalidation study, or if they want those data to go to the respective courts, and then the courts transfer those data to the respective vendor or research group doing the work. In terms of sample size, there are different strategies to determine your minimum sample size for these analyses. What our group did was use something called MegCalc, which is a sample size calculator recommended by the National Institutes of Health. And we determined that preferably we would like to have 2,000 cases each from Clark and Washoe counties. So that sounds like that's feasible from each of those counties. The rural and or frontier counties is where this gets more challenging. No one expects that any single rural or frontier jurisdiction is going to have 2,000 cases. That is just unrealistic. But it's really important, I think, to assess the performance of the NPRA in the rural and frontier jurisdictions to determine whether or not it's performing the way it ought to. This is an understudied area as a general matter with respect to all things criminal justice and with respect to assessments. So one of the ways that we proposed to manage this particular issue was to aggregate data from rural or frontier jurisdictions. So our initial scope of work proposed that we were collecting these data from all of our rural and frontier jurisdictions that we could have involved in the project, hoping to approximate or to develop the largest sample possible from those courts. And of course, what we can do then is indicate which jurisdiction the data are coming from. So if our subsample sizes by jurisdiction happen to be large enough, then we might be able to discern what's happening in one rural county versus another rural county. But there is no guarantee that those subsamples would be large enough to do that. But collectively, if we aggregate data across rural and frontier counties, of course, there are differences across these counties. However, they are more alike in terms of court process, environment, resources. They're more alike with each other than they are, say, for example, Clark or Washoe County. So that helps us develop a larger sample from the rural and frontier courts. And then ultimately, what we're able to do is to assess the tool's performance inside of Clark County, inside of Washoe County, and then inside of the rural and frontier courts collectively. And then we can assess the performance, the relative performance of the tool across Clark County, Washoe County, and then the aggregated group of rural and frontier courts. With respect to how we would pull 2,000 cases from Clark and Washoe, which both have annual NPRA assessments far in excess of that, which I'm happy to hear. I'm happy to hear it's being used that widely. One way that we can do this, and if it's not feasible, there's some other strategies that we can explore, would be to essentially, we narrow down what time period do you want to use. So in the initial scope of work, I proposed January 1st, 2022, through December 31st, 2023, because I was unsure how many of these assessments were actually being conducted in any year. But we can narrow that time period if we want to. And then during that time period, you would basically assemble a case of everybody who came through the court at least the first time and assign them, you know, a unique identifying number. And then we would do something like a random number generator. And then those cases that are identified with those numbers, we just selectively pull the data on those cases. 2,000 per jurisdiction is slightly over what we would need as a bare minimum to run the analyses. But that 2,000 gives us a little bit of wiggle room because that's not uncommon to find. In some cases, you're simply missing critical information, and you're missing either a very important piece of information or you're missing enough information in enough places that it doesn't make sense to retain that case in the sample. So if we pull 2,000, then we ultimately have a situation where even if we have, say, 100 or 200 cases that we simply can't use because of data issues, we still have an adequate number of cases to run those analyses. Yep, so I'm happy to answer any additional questions that you might have.
Anybody have any questions? Kevin, do you want to ask your question?
Well, I went from no to maybe to Vanjie telling me you don't know what you're talking about. So apparently it's a question without an answer. So no, I'm good.
No, I don't think it's not a question without an answer. I think Jessica answered this, I think, in the most honest way possible. It's a maybe. So you can include in data collection per case a variable for the court and or the name of the person who conducted the assessment. You can also collect the name of the judge who is ultimately making the release decision and whether or not that decision is consistent with what's recommended by the tool. If those data are available per case, they're not always available. If they are available, you can collect them. There's no guarantee there's enough information within a jurisdiction to produce meaningful analyses, right? So if the data are available and there are enough cases, it's possible you might be able to provide that answer. But it's really going to be a function of what you find in the data once you go looking.
Anybody else? Yeah, Judge Armstrong.
So I've been wondering how, when I use the NPRA, I set bail and I set conditions of the bail based upon the score. You know, 1 through 4 gets less conditions, 5 through 8 gets more. And, you know, I look at everything and I don't know how we're going to parse out the effectiveness of the score versus the effectiveness of the conditions, how they're applied and how they're enforced. That's because that's a big variable, and the score is one thing, and that might set the table for how I treat that particular case. But the conditions are a huge variable from start to finish, and I haven't heard anybody really talk about that. That's just
well, we can collect those data under. In my initial scope of work, there's a list of variables. So under the bail and release information section, you know, initially included in there this method of release bail amount, we can simply include a variable in there. What are the conditions of release? And we can collect the data on that in conjunction with the court. Now, it really depends ultimately. So we know as part of that background prep process, you know, if you're internal to your court, the policy is scores here. This is the type of conditions they get. Scores here. This is the type of conditions they get. Okay, we know in this court, this is the policy. This is how the results of the assessment are being used. And then that helps us interpret the data on the back end. So what we're seeing on the back end in terms of results. If there are enough cases, then we might be able to understand the role that those release conditions are playing. But again, it's really going to depend on the number of cases coming from your jurisdiction, as well as to the completeness of the data. So you might have a relatively small number of cases, let's say it's 300, but you've got complete data across all of them, that's different than having a huge number of cases where you have super incomplete data. So again, it's possible we can build into the data collection a variable for that, and then we can determine at the analytical stage whether or not it's producing any kind of meaningful effect on the outcome.
Thank you.
Judge Armstrong, that is a question that I've always had also. Is that variable on the conditions? And I guess my question is, when they kept, and each of the presenters has referred to a recommendation, I was going to ask the other jurisdictions, do you guys actually get a recommendation or do you just have that score? And that score, to some degree, in my mind, has always been a little meaningless in that it doesn't say, okay, if you're high level, you should be on high level EMP, electronic monitoring, or blah, blah, blah. So when Dr. Lanterman is talking about policies, I don't know here, even in Las Vegas Justice Court, that there's any policy as to what that score should translate into when you're talking about a release condition. So I've always had questions about that when we talk about validation, because there's no true recommendation. And what I think should happen on a moderate level offender might not even be close to what you think should happen on a moderate level offender. That doesn't mean I'm not following the NPR. It just means that I have no guidance as to how I should proceed. So I've always wondered how that falls into this revalidation. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Well, the recommendations are going to be crazy hard to do because you have somebody who's on a use or a possession charge and they score an 18. Is going to be different than somebody who's a domestic third or a misdemeanor domestic and scores a 4 or vice versa. I mean, you're not going to want to put testing and counseling and all of that drug counseling on somebody who's got a domestic, even though they score really high. So it's got to take in the charges of history and just got to be some kind of a intuition sometimes, because it's everybody's, people are different and they're messy and we're trying to quantify them and you can only take it so far. And if we're going to look at trying to set conditions, I mean, I've got 22 on my list of standard ones I check if they want them or not. Some I rarely ever use, some that I do, and there's some on there that I have a catch-all, and then there's going to be some that Tom orders that I am never going to order just because I don't have any ability to have them check in or do that sort of stuff. So conditions are going to be another can of worms beyond. And it would be nice to know which ones were effective, though. Another thing that occurred to me is how long are these people out? In rural jurisdictions, we can move really fast, whereas in Vegas, they could wait years for a trial. And so that's going to skew all the numbers, too. I could be letting out bad people, but we get them done so fast, they haven't had a chance to screw up.
I think that the revalidation of whether or not the NPRA is predictive for reoffense or FTA is different than whether or not the conditions are effective. And it's my understanding that while it is fascinating to dive into, is electronic monitoring profitable and to what extent, the questions on the NPRA being predictive to reoffense or FTA is really kind of the scope of this committee. And I, Judge De La Garza and Judge Higgins, I definitely understand that perhaps maybe I will tell you that if we have somebody that's drug testing, we are way more likely to put them into custody for a technical violation because we don't have the same resources to say, we're going to order that you are immediately clean and sober, that you immediately abstain from something that you're addicted to without any assistance to their efforts for sobriety. So that entire supervision in 2015, when this came about, I think that they were saying use this to set bail for reoffense or FTAs, but there was no instruction on how to order conditions. And then in the last 10 years, we've been ordered to make clear and on the record specific conditions, least restrictive by clear and convincing evidence that it's relevant to either reoffense or FTA, which again is going to change the data for all of you really smart presenters here. We went from saying basic, medium, enhanced, and having blanket conditions associated with those scores to having specific conditions set on the record. So opening up the worm can of worms about conditions may be different.
Well, then I
I'll
think
leave with this. I only brought it up because I don't know how, if you're going to be doing this work, you can validate the effectiveness of the tool separate from what might have an equally, if not higher, practical impact on the defendant's performance as the conditions that are imposed in each case. So, with that complication pointed out, I'll leave it to you, brainiacs, to sort it out for us down the road. But that is. I don't know how we're going to do that, and I'm not smart enough to suggest any ways to do that.
Well, but I think, Angelina, to Steve's point, there's also a difference between time and conditions. And he's right in terms of the expeditiousness with which they can get something. Because, look, anybody, the vast, vast majority of people in the criminal justice system, if they get released, they're trying to do their best, right? But let's say somebody has a significant substance abuse issue. They may be able to do okay for a couple of months and following up on things. And then that may take hold again if they're waiting a year and a half in Las Vegas Justice Court to get their case resolved, versus if it's only going to take a couple of months to get it resolved and then they're under sentence, in which case that's not a part of what we're looking at. The predictability of failure to appear or reoffense is somewhat, affected by being able to get a case done quickly before somebody could potentially have a problem versus how long it takes in the bigger jurisdictions to get those cases all the way through. I still think the tool is very, very helpful, just so long as everybody, we've said this from the beginning, the tool's a tool, right? The tool isn't something that you look at and say, well, absolutely, the tool says this, so we do this, right? You just use it, understanding it's going to have flaws and imperfections like anything else that we do as judges, both as human beings and as trying to, engage. The wonderful Supreme Court building has toilets that flush, randomly every so often. So that's why you just heard that. Which is another reason why I think Johann Lowy wanted to sell the building to the state and get out from being our landlord. But in any event, it's going to have its warts and imperfections. We kind of do the best we can with it. Did anybody else have any questions of Dr. Lanterman? Or any other questions for any of our presenters that have come up as we've gone through each of the presentations?
Would it be possible to expand the rural samples outside of just White Pine? Just for spitballing it, I just went through and looked through the report from a couple of years ago and pulled every county that didn't have a Walmart. And I think that got us about 1,500 cases.
Yeah, I think it's probably best if you can get more rural and frontier jurisdictions on board to have multiple jurisdictions involved, and we'll collect sort of like the total population of the cases, ultimately decide what the study period is going to be. Collect the total population of cases from those jurisdictions, create a larger sample. And the benefit of the larger sample is that it's you have better, more sensitive analyses, right? Less risk of certain types of error, things like that, right? So I think it's really because Nevada has this very interesting population distribution where it's primarily bimodal between Clark and Washoe. But then there's a huge part of the state that's rural and frontier. And most of what we understand about Nevada comes from Clark and Washoe. But that doesn't mean there aren't really meaningful, important things happening in rural and frontier areas. But we have to have enough statistical power to be able to answer those questions. And that comes down basically to sample size. So anything we could do to increase that sample size in those rural jurisdictions is really going to sort of redound to the benefit of the state. So if you get more rural jurisdictions on board, the better it is.
We might get some more buy-in too if we include them some more. It won't be quite as foisted on them because they work with
Let
us.
me ask this question before we let our presenters go, because I know Dr. Landerman's original scope of work that had a budget summary in it was when we were presuming we were going to do the whole state. And so we kind of knew what that number was for a broader thing that we've narrowed it down to now. For Ms. Hickman and Ms. O'Connor, if we were to add, let's say, a couple of other small rural jurisdictions, would that significantly change your estimated cost? Understanding that you're looking at jurisdictions that sometimes may only have, less than 100 criminal cases a year.
And no, it wouldn't significantly impact our costs.
Okay. Ms. Hickman?
No, not significantly. I would say the only probably cost increase would be staff time if we were dealing with more paper
Okay.
records.
Okay. All right. One last time. Anybody have any more questions for our presenters before we let them go?
I apologize. I do. I
Yeah,
just
go
want to
ahead.
clarify, for each of the presenters, the responsibility for review of criminal history will be different based on the presenters. It's my understanding that Ms. O'Connor, for your bid and your presentation, it would be incumbent upon the individual jurisdictions to run the criminal histories to determine rearrest. Is that correct?
Correct.
And then Ms. Hickman, is it my understanding that it would be on CJI to run criminal history however you choose to do it?
Correct, we do that.
Okay, and Dr. Lanterman?
If we can get access to the systems where the criminal history data are available, then we can do it. If those agencies are unwilling to provide access, then we need to come up with an arrangement where the agency provides the data to us.
Those, because those are very different lifts for our Vegas, our partners down in Vegas, right? So, just
So that's
want
why I'm wondering just, with the, again, with the Nevada Criminal Justice or Criminal History Repository, if that might be one place to look. Because if they're able to do it, then that reduces some of the work on the individual jurisdictions, particularly if you're able to develop like an effort, whatever the distribution of labor would be between the criminal history repository and ultimately the research group that's handling the revalidation, right?
is it statistically relevant to only check Nevada for rearrest history versus doing a complete and CG and CSIS?
I would love a national review of criminal history because Nevada in particular has a very transient population. People come and go a lot, particularly from Clark and Washoe County across the board. We've got three other states that are directly like where you've got a lot of a population movement. But I do know in the past when we've done this work with other state agencies, there has been a lot of reluctance to access those data. So that's ideal. If agencies are not willing to do that, then the Criminal History Repository is probably the next best place to look. So that's really sort of a, the group I think would have to come together and decide, are we going to work something out so the respective research team can have those national data or not? And then if not, what's plan B? Is it Criminal History Repository, or are we going to have to go to individual law enforcement agencies looking for arrest data?
assuming
Which, from my
this
experience,
position
going to I'm
home
sorry,
office
Judge,
having
going
lunch
to
maybe.
individual agencies to look for rest data is a whole different ball of wax. A lot of police departments do not want to share that kind of information. You know, I think I would be surprised if they would if you could get every police jurisdiction to agree to provide that or to have someone look into their data sets for that kind of information.
Kevin?
Well, we're assuming that dispositions have been reported. So that's a big poll.
It is, but also that depends in part on the timeline for which you want to collect data. That's more of a problem if it's more recent, if it's 2024 or 2025. It's less of a problem if you're collecting data from 2022 or 2023, because there would be any data set, any data repository would be more current the further you go back, right? So, you know, ultimately the committee would have to decide on what the desired time period is for this study. But if you stay away from 2025 for sure, and potentially 2024, that becomes less of a problem.
And we're just looking for arrest history, right? We're not looking for dispositions because we're
Yeah.
looking for rearrests, which based on fingerprints, right? So those arrests go in based on fingerprints, regardless of the reporting of the dispositions.
Anybody else? Nope. All right. Thank you all again, very much, Ms. O'Connor, Ms. Hickman, Dr. Yang, Ms. Mead, Dr. Lanterman. We appreciate your time today, the time that went into producing your scopes of work as well. We're going to go ahead and take a break here for a few minutes and then come back, and the committee can have some discussions, and we'll figure out, how we want to move forward in terms of things we talk about. We can have general discussions today about how we want to move forward, whether we're going to vote today. I don't even know, Almeida, if we still have a quorum or not, because I know we've lost a few people. But everybody go ahead and take a bathroom break or whatever for about 10 minutes, and then we'll get started back up.
Thanks everyone so much.
Thank you
Thank
so
you, everybody.
much.
Sure.
Thanks everyone.
Thanks everyone.
Do you want us to sign off and then sign back on or just stay on?
You do whatever you want, Mel. I'm just sitting here at my desk, but I don't think you need to sign off. You can mute video and audio if you want, or you can just sit there and work, and we'll all voyeuristically watch you work at your desk. If it makes you feel better, I'll leave my video on as well.
Chief Justice, do you mind if I pause the recording just for this portion? Excellent. Thank you.
Wait a second here and see, make sure we get everybody else joined back on. Ryan, do you start back at 2?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Let me just open it up then for a general discussion about the presentations and thoughts that anybody has. I mean, it's a pretty wide variety. If I've got numbers right, it looks like CGL is saying it's something that should take about 6 months, and their estimated budget was $35,000. CGI seems to be saying it's about 9 months and with a budget of $200,000. And then Dr. Lanterman at UNR, I don't know that she specified, but it looks like she's saying over the course of 2 years. With a budget of about $111,000. She's the one we had reached out to her to ask about how the budget would change if we confined it to the three counties versus the whole state. And then we got that follow-up letter that kind of indicated the budget was pretty much fixed, so it wasn't going to change. Anybody have any thoughts they want to throw out for discussion?
I liked the expertise of two. Now that I hear their price, I'm a little bit less thrilled with them. I
Okay.
like three. The third one's experience and knowledge of Nevada, though. That those two are kind of my top two.
Okay. Yeah, I was a little surprised by CGI's budget. And I get it's kind of based on the number of people they have working on it and their expertise. I tended towards that when I was just reading it. And then obviously I was like, whoa, that budget's pretty tall order. And I don't know if any of these organizations are going to be willing to have discussions about any modifications to their budget. But anybody else? Yep, go ahead, Randall.
Was just wondering, Mel, and maybe I missed this, but Mel, that's the company that is working with the CJCC right now, right? In Clark County?
Yes, CGI, the second one.
Yeah.
Okay. And they're charging $70,000 for what they're doing for you?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
So they are like worlds above, it seems like everybody else.
So
And
this is like 200 on top of that 70, right?
well, see, that's a good question. I would think that it is, but on the
it
other
is.
hand, it's the same. They would be doing the same thing for Clark County that they're doing for us in terms of validating the tool, right, Mel?
Yes, but I looked at when I looked at their scope of work, this amended scope of work, I believed, unless I looked through it too quickly, I believed that they eliminated Clark because, oh, maybe not. Okay. Yeah, because see, they say the Clark County District Court. So in their this proposal, it's Second Judicial and the Clark County District Court. So they don't put in here Clark County Justice Court because they
Well,
will have already done Clark County Justice Court as part of what they're getting paid for now. So that's 200 on top of the 70, I believe.
they don't put in justice courts in Reno either. They put it in as the Second Judicial District Court.
Oh, okay. You know what? You're
So
right.
I don't know if that's just a semantic error on their behalf, where they're just kind of characterizing it as Clark County, Washoe County, Ely Justice Court. Or whether they're intentional in that to say we're exclusive of the justice courts.
So I guess we would need some clarification there.
And I can have Jamie follow up and talk to them a little bit to figure that out. So where are they in terms of what you're doing with them in Clark County?
So literally, we just got the contract signed, and this is Lindsay from CJCC, just got the contract signed. Now I have in front of me that I still need to review the data sharing agreement.
Okay.
So we're still looking at agreements. So I need to sit down and look through that data sharing agreement to see how that's going to work. And that was one of the things that I was asking about in terms of how they get the data. So, and it's my understanding that they've already, to some degree, talked with RIT, said, okay, this is how, or do you have this data set, this data set, this data set? And then they pull it and then they have an agreement to take it out of our Odyssey or we send it to them. But I need to look at the specifics as to how that's done because that is the one thing for our rurals that is going to be very different is
Right.
that data collection because they're on paper. So that's as far as we've gotten. We haven't actually delved into any of the work itself.
Well, and I don't know how anybody else feels, but I mean that the trial courts are kind of irrelevant here. The NPRAs are all pretty much being done at the limited jurisdiction court level. It's very rare that you need to get one in district court. Sometimes you're going to get one because a case comes in on an indictment. Sometimes somebody may ask for one on a bail motion in district court, even though there had already been one and rulings made in the justice court. But that's minuscule compared to what's happening in the justice courts and the municipal courts around the state. So I'm not sure why their focus was on district court. And that's, again, why I feel like maybe it was just like a semantic thing where they just used that term, but that's not really what the focus is.
Well, one of the discussions that we did have, and I think Stephen has brought up this point also, is that even though we are making the bail decision down in justice court, that case then has to proceed, well, in a smaller number amount, that case does proceed to the district court. And right. So you still have that opportunity at failure to appear and or rearrest. And that's why they included the district court. But that's why on our level, we decided that number is such a small percentage.
Right.
That we were just going to proceed because we were having a tough time coordinating that. And it did right. seem like just the justice court. But then Stephen said a lot of his cases go to the district court. So it sounds like it's different for the rules. That percentage might be higher.
So looking at the data here, I have 279 criminal cases and 130 in the district court.
Wow.
So about half of mine go up.
Wow. See, that's, you know, Doug, here it's a much right. smaller percentage.
A lot of our misdemeanors are dealt with on citations. Or Muni Court does 150 misdemeanors a year.
Well, what anybody else on the presentations? Any thoughts on? Yeah, Kevin.
Well, the one seems high. I think the other one seems remarkably low. I don't know how they're going to do what they say they're going to do for $35,000. I mean,
yeah, I thought maybe they were missing a digit there.
Because you know, it's paying somebody $100 an hour. You know, maybe
right.
that's only 350 working hours. There's a lot of data. I don't think it's going to be as easy to get to as they think. So I don't want to reject them out of hand, but it seems to me like it's a low bid.
And Kevin, to your point, it does seem low, but I also noticed that they are putting a heavy burden on the court itself by saying, we're just going to supply you. And this is one thing I wrote down. We're just going to supply you with a form. And you are going to get the data and send it to us.
Right,
so
right.
they're not going to be out there looking at the rearrests. They're not going to be looking at the failure to appears. They're just going to send us a form. And my pretrial service department, Amy specifically, is going to be the one collecting all the data and just sending it to them on their form, which I'm wondering is going to be the spreadsheet itself.
We're
and the NPRA point.
I'm going to get the AOC to send Amy a case of Rockstar energy drink every week while she cruises.
Please do.
And not just that, we're going to have to enter all the points on the NPRA into their form too, which is going to be another third
right.
project.
And I'll be honest with you, I know currently our pretrial services department is stretched, as we all are. But to imagine them getting 1,000 cases, which I still didn't understand that percentage, because she said for you, Steve, she wanted 500 cases. And then I gave out my astronomical number and she said, yeah, 500 to 1,000. And I thought, okay, well, that seems like a very, very, very small percentage.
She
well,
wanted like 20% a year and 200%.
Yeah, there's
a
difference between the total number of cases they need to be able to feel comfortable in that being a representative number versus a small jurisdiction that doesn't even have that number of cases. So in a small jurisdiction, they may want 50% of their cases. In a bigger jurisdiction, they only need 500 to 1,000 individual case or individuals to kind of run numbers off of. I mean, that part actually made sense to me. I get where they're coming from.
Oh, really? Okay.
We just gave them all to Dr. Austin.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, It worked out okay. What about you, Angelina, up in the second? What did you think about the three?
Thank you. I think that I'm concerned about how CJI is planning to run rearrests, going to different law enforcement agencies. While they said they're planning on getting that data for us, I don't think it's going to be indicative of an. I don't think it's going to be accurate. But to Dr. Lanterman's point, when she said, "Man, we have a lot of people coming in from other states, coming through here to Washoe and Clark County," if we are just at the mercy of law enforcement agencies to report whether or not they've been rearrested, I don't think that that's going to be a accurate number or give good data. And I wish that they were here for me to say, like, how are you planning on co-opting these law enforcement agencies to determine rearrest when they said themselves that sometimes that's a different ball of wax and it's tricky. The only way I could see getting an accurate number for rearrests, doing NPRA myself. Amy, I bet you do the NPRA too. When you see somebody here, you are immediately looking for that California history. Where's that California history? If we were only asking Nevada, well, I appreciate her numbers higher and the idea that there'd be a less of a stretch on our teams, Your Honor, to run those data. I don't know how they're going to do it accurately. I appreciate how Dr. Lanterman was able to identify the different makeup of our state, and I expect that many of you would be interested in how the NPRA works in the frontier and rural counties in a more meaningful way.
Amy?
I agree. I think Dr. Lanterman's was, to me, by far, her understanding the state and understanding that, I hate to say that they had a doctor research assistant that will be helping do some of that research and that work, just for me, also helped out. So we are stretched very thin up here, and I think even just I told Judge De La Garza that it was probably going to be me that was going to be doing most of the work, just because my team is stretched so thin. So for me to run 1,000 cases, I'm a little
That's it's a lot.
What concerns, if any, do you have, Mel, about CGI's proposal on getting rearrest data?
Do you have concerns because we're running up against that even for just Las Vegas Justice Court that we've been talking about? It seems like there has been some questions about whether they're going to go to Metro or how they're actually going to get this information. They've assured us as long as we point them in the direction, they're going to get it. But I have my doubts a little bit as to this rearrest situation. I do. I don't know.
Well, I guess.
Can we just run NCIC for each of the cases that we give them? I mean, would that just kind of be the answer? It's just, I mean, I know it's 1,000 NCICs, but this is going to be over a course of six months to a year.
Let me simplify something here, and I might be simplifying it far too much, but how generally do any of us find out that somebody got rearrested? Go
Attorney,
ahead,
file a
Judge
motion.
Watson.
I know most of them.
Well, okay. So let you know most of them, right? So you saw them get arrested that weekend.
That's
I get it.
right.
But generally speaking, it's going to be that you go to court for the next hearing, the status check, whatever, and somebody says, guy's in custody, he got rearrested.
Right.
The
Or
attorney
there's a
says,
bench
my
warrant.
client got arrested. They're in custody in Arizona right now on a felony, da 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 da. Or they just don't show up, in which case we don't know they were arrested for anything. We just know they're in FDA mode now. So
That's
I
right.
guess I'm somewhat less concerned about how they're going to assess arrest data, because usually the only reason we're going to know about the arrest is it's going to be represented in court, and the courts are going to be able to direct certain things. I don't know how I turned my video off, sorry. And like I said, I might be just oversimplifying that, but it's not like we're just constantly going to be running NCICs or contacting Metro or anything else just because people haven't appeared. The attorneys may do that to make sure they're not in custody in city jail when they didn't show up in justice court or something, but
I think when we did it to check when we were developing the instrument is we just ran the through the we ran an NCIC report. Washoe did ours because my court doesn't have access to it. And they just sent me a list of, I think they actually filled out that half of the NPRA, and then I filled out the other half myself. So
Oh, is
that's it.
that how you did it?
But it,
So that
so,
was
Angelina,
essentially the
let me
form.
ask Angelina, to your point, I get and I agree that Dr. Landerman is much more familiar with Nevada and the structure of our state and the counties, et cetera. But what would you have that entity do to more accurately assess arrest data other than saying, oh, I'm going to check California first?
I would like to clarify with Dr. Lanterman her plan. She
Okay.
did talk a couple time about trying to discuss with the Nevada State Repository. You know,
Okay.
she said a couple different things. She said, "Hey, I'd like to talk to the Nevada State Repository to determine if they were going to co-labor with us for that lift." Based on her, she's what, like $111,000 and a
Right.
2 year experience.
Right.
But with Dr. Lanterman, I don't know if she's planning on getting rearrest data or if that is going to be incumbent upon Amy and I. And if that's if the juice is worth the squeeze, so to speak, for us to get a better data, if Amy
Okay.
and I did do it over 2 years, plus Dr. Lanterman did express willingness to review supervision conditions in conjunction with
Yes.
FTA and rearrest. So I don't know if CGI would also be willing to discuss that as much as Dr. Lanterman was willing to discuss that. And it sounds to me, Judge Higgins, that that's something that is it is piques the curiosity and is completely relevant to whether or not somebody is able to come. Maybe we find out that somebody, if they're on testing, are more likely to appear or more likely to not appear. I don't know. So
Okay.
those are the things that are rumbling through my brain, but I'd love to clarify with Dr. Lanterman what her plan is for who would be responsible for those criminal histories.
Look, I think that's a tremendous idea, and I would send it out to all of them, just saying, "Hey, we'd like a little follow-up. If you could put something together in writing about how you're going to collate rearrest data, NCIC, local jurisdictions, neighboring states, whatever it's going to be." So that we can get some sense of the accuracy of that. We could also ask CGI in that follow-up, how would the budget for this be impacted by the contract you have with Clark County to do this for Clark County already? Because, Mel, as you know, we've discussed this. If we don't choose CGI, then you guys are spending 70 grand on something that's going to become essentially irrelevant because once the commission finishes its work and says, we've revalidated this tool in this manner, the court's going to issue an administrative order, I'm sure, that says everybody needs to use the new NPRA tool. So if you guys have created something different down there with them, that's not really going to be valid.
Does
If
sorry.
I ask that brings me to one of the notes that I wrote. I can't remember which, and maybe it was CJI that said they'll look at the data by jurisdiction and then they'll look at the data as a whole. And they did start talking about how the data might be very different depending on the jurisdiction. And I thought to myself, is there a possibility that we end up with different NPRs? Because I, to some degree, wonder whether the factors and the predictability really is the same for a Las Vegas versus an Ely. Just a question.
And I think it's probably not going to be because we don't admin OR anybody. We bring them in, we talk to them, I find get their address, phone number, where they work from, and get a sense if they're a lunatic or not. Or sometimes they're just seething with rage, and they're not getting out, whether they're a
Are you
zero
talking
or a
about
two.
defendants or attorneys?
Well, it
Okay, just making sure.
or a judge some days.
And that right there, that is a very, very different procedure. Every single one of our misdemeanor defendants is released on admin OR before we see them, other than I think four categories: DUI, DV, violation of the order out. Imagine that. And then which other one, Amy?
Violation of prohibited contact.
Yeah, like TPO. Order. TPO, like violation of TPO.
Mm-hmm.
Every other misdemeanor. So, Steve, do you run NPRs on those?
Mm-hmm. Everybody who gets arrested has an NPR. A good example was last week. We had a case come in. I thought, why are we having this hearing? He's a zero. It's a misdemeanor. Well, it turns out he just got out of prison for some fairly violent stuff. And before he went, he had like four FDA. They had to track him down four times before they finally put him in jail.
Just never know.
And that's what's enlightening again about, okay, these hearings are valuable. Because some days I feel like, why am I wasting time on this? But then usually the state has something. Or sometimes you come in and they look like they're 19. And it turns out it's not. There's some error or there's something where it's not. Or you can just tell. We had somebody who was accused of shooting their wife. It was clearly like a Farrah Fawcett burning bed sort of thing going on. And I ignored the NPRA and released her. And it turns out I was right.
But I think that to the point of the smarty pants that were on our thing today, they're going to look at the release type, the NPRA score, and then if they reoffended, or if how we do administrative releases in Washoe and Clark, because we have an administrative release procedure as well, how we do those is not going to be relevant to the NPRA revalidation. It's just going to create the data necessary to determine if whether or not the release type, where did they score? How did they get released? And did they reoffend or did they get FTA? Were they FTA during that time? It is going to help identify the predictivity of the tool. Where it gets sticky is when we really do start talking about the supervision conditions.
Jelena, we don't do NPRs on any of those.
Right. And same in Washoe County. If it's a less serious misdemeanor out of Reno Municipal or Sparks Municipal, we don't either. The only time rearrest them, or excuse me, the only time they're not given an administrative release on an own recognizance is if we can verify in the county that they have a pending case. Like if you already have a pending case, is that yes, you, Amy?
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Let's go, us. Yeah. Let's go.
back to Mel's point earlier. I don't think the court is going to favor saying, nope, we need a separate NPRI or an NPR tool for every county. Look, if that was the case, I would just say, we're out of it. You guys go do it. Every county go do their own. But not every county can afford to do their own. And at the end of the day, look, I mean, despite the geographic diversity of our state and the nature of urban and rural areas, people are kind of people. And you get tendencies from looking at the data in these tools, and the tool, again, it's just to help you make that decision. You can evaluate that individual within your jurisdiction and what you know about things, in addition to whatever the tool gives you about predictability based on, whatever data has been ascertained. So, well, let's do this. I know I've kept you around for a long time today. Let me get with Almeda and Jamie and put together some further requests for each of the folks to get us regarding the rearrest issue. We'll ask CGI and Mel, and you guys can follow up with them if you want as well. But how does this budget affect the contract that was just signed? And when you say just signed, meaning how recently just signed?
Within the last 30 days.
Okay. Because I don't remember exactly what date their report came out. So that may have not been reflective of them now being in contract with you all. But we can see what, if any, movement there can be on that as well. And then I'll get all that out to everybody. We can have another meeting to discuss further which one we want to move on. We can submit the reports, you know, circulate them by email to everybody to take a look at. I know sometimes it's kind of hard to schedule meetings. My preference would be to get another meeting just so people can have an opportunity to chat, including some of the people that maybe saw the things today but had to leave a little early. So I'm going to start with that idea, and I'll have Almeda kind of circulate a doodle poll or whatever it is to figure out dates that we can get together again, maybe in about 45 days to give these organizations time to give us some follow-up supplemental reports.
May I ask, or This is Garrett Pruitt. Two quick things that I had thought of. If Clark County has already signed on with CGI, is there anything, should we go with another one if that ultimately is the choice? Is there anything that would prohibit that other group from also considering what CGI has done in Clark County as a comparative data set? So if they're paying for it anyway, the thought being Clark County has their results, and if you have a different group, then you can put them side by side and we have an efficacy thing there. And the other thing I had possibly considered, if we do work with UNR on this, does it give us or does it allow us to have a longer lasting relationship and a little bit more ownership of the data to use it going forward, whether if we want to look at conditions and the other things to then further reevaluate it because we're working within the state with UNR rather than another business who may want more money to see our own data again and manipulate it?
Those
Both very good points. Your first point, Garrett, I think makes a lot of logical sense to all of us as attorneys, but I have a minor in statistics. So I can tell you that most organizations would say, if I don't have any input into how you collect that data, how you collate it, and all of that stuff, then I can't just use it per se, and expect that it's all accurate and valid and I can make it work for myself. They might, I don't know. Particularly the 35 grand. They may, they're going to take stuff from the courts asking us to fill out forms and kind of give them stuff. So they may be a little different in accepting other data. But my sense from knowing Dr. Lannerman a little bit through sentencing commission and whatnot, she's going to want to, collect everything on her own to come up with something that at the end of the day she's going to have to sign off on. And I would guess CGI would probably say the same if they were trying to get data from somebody else. I don't know, Mel, if that's come up with any conversations you all have had.
Actually, we did have this conversation, and they said they hand over everything. They hand over your data, they hand over their methodology, they hand over what conclusions they drew from that data. Because I asked that question, and she said, "We give you everything. So then you do what you want to do with that information." And she said it may or may not be helpful to the next group, but they do not try to keep your, oh, okay, you only paid for this and you can't use this data now.
Yeah, no, I mean it's not about the data because for the most part, any of these organizations can get the data because Steve's got a very small amount of paper data and the other jurisdictions, it's extractable, right? So it's not getting the data, it's what does that data mean? So they're going to have conclusions and everything in there that I don't think any other organization is going to accept their conclusions on the data. They're going to say, I got to go back in wherever I get the data from, straight from the court or somebody else that got it from the court. I got to go back in and do my own, stuff to it, so to speak.
And I didn't expect them to accept the conclusion. I just looked at it as the thought, well, they have their conclusions. We've collected our data from Clark County as well. Now I can, what parallels do we have? Where do we have discrepancies to see if our methodology was in fact good?
If they both agree, that says something. If they're completely at odds, that says something else.
Well, okay, so that's something that we can include Almeida as well in the letters that we sent out, for instance, to Dr. Lannerman. If CGI has a contract to do this already in Clark County, would there be anything that was, would she be able to utilize that data as part of, or whatever she can get from CGI as part of her overall perspective for the state? And would that affect her budget summary?
Sorry about the phone.
Yeah, go ahead.
The only thing I'd be cautious about is if UNR is going to be relying on the repository data, I don't have much faith in the data from the state repository. Things aren't
We're
reported
working
there.
on that, Kevin. That's one of
Well,
my
it was all Jim
that's one
Hardesty's
of
fault.
my
They
things.
testified at the legislature. It was all Jim Hardesty's fault. Their data was.
I
I've never
know.
seen anybody turn red faster in my entire life. But they have every day I'm doing bail and they say, well, no disposition, no disposition, no disposition. So repository, we're not reporting, the DA's not reporting, I don't know. But maybe that's a start, but I think we're gonna still have to run all these people through NCIC if you really want an accurate backup.
But disposition isn't as important as the arrest, but should be already there through the fingerprinting. That's why we did arrests and not convictions, because of that mess.
But my bail hearing every day, they go over a list of arrests and there's no dispositions on any of them. So what does that mean? It really doesn't mean much, frankly, but sorry about the phone, though. I gotta
No,
go.
no. You're okay. Hey, look, I got a phantom toilet flushing. Don't worry about your phone. I'm all good.
All right.
Okay. Anybody else have anything for the good of the order before we go ahead and break? All right. This was a long one, so I appreciate everybody's time this afternoon. Thank you. And we'll see you back probably in about 45 days.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate the discussion.
Thank you.
Thanks, all. It was one of the most interesting meetings I've been on.
Well, great.
Great.